Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as we continue educating and continue diving into the Constitution and all these critical source documents that you need to understand, we basically are doing this so that you can build on that trifecta of learn, pray, act. That way you can be more efficacious in your actions. But it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. And abandoning agendas is critical. Folks, there are so many patriots. As a matter of fact, some of you may actually be involved in agendas, and you may not even realize it. And so I'm just going to kind of cover this real quick. If you're involved in general assemblies, if you're involved in creating formal committees of safety, anything that goes back under the guise of the British Constitution and when we were a part of the British Empire, which is what those things are, then you are basically being fooled into buying into old functionalities that were only existent under the British Empire. When we went and created the Declaration of Independence and started going down our path of a republican form of government, all that went away. The concept of sheriffs being able to form grand juries is under the auspices of the British Empire and the British Constitution, the Magna Carta and the Glorious Bill of Rights. The sheriff is not the executive of your county. Now, you may make him that, then, okay, that means that that's constitutional. But near as I can tell, I do not know of any county that has created a constitution. Ergo, if you think he's de facto de jure, which to me that language is just a red flag, but if you think that he is a legitimate executive, then you have to really rethink yourself, because your sheriff's jurisdiction does not and cannot exceed the county boundaries. A true executive has what we would call emissary duties and emissary capabilities, where they can reach and make deals across county lines and so forth, where they can actually make appeals to businesses and so forth to come into your county. Now, the sheriff doesn't do that and shouldn't do that, and that's not his job. Technically, in a constitutional county, he has a very important role. His role is the commander of the militia, but he's not the commander-in-chief of the county. That would be your executive if you had one. But if you don't, then he's the commander, and he reports to a civilian authority, which would be your county legislators. Don't be buying into these concocted ideas that under our Constitution, we still possess those artifacts under the British Empire and the monarchical theocracy, because the reason why these committees of safety, assemblies, councils, during the dismissal by King George of our governments in the colonies and his appointment of his own governors, they had a right to do that. They had a right to create a representative body to work together to petition the king for a redress of grievances, which is exactly what they did. They can't create this representative body to be a government itself. It has very specific limitations, because the king is the king. And in our constitutional republic, we no longer have a king. The law is our king. And we already have a representative government. So for you to go off and create a new representative government, I'm scratching my head asking you to try to help me understand how doing that is not a shadow government. And that's exactly what these General Assembly, Committees of Safety, the all these different people that are going around, and there's a lot of money involved in this, and I can't believe it. And it's not like you're seeing the money. It is, this is a hardcore press to attack patriots, to get them to get engaged in this dangerous proposition that will do nothing. And if you're familiar with the farm statement regarding boars having teats, then you can understand why this is about as relevant as those teats on a boar. Because bottom line, they do nothing. There's no legitimacy behind this. Now, there are a few artifacts from court cases, judges, and so forth, where they've kind of had this lapse of logic and reason and have looked back in the history and said, yeah, well, they did have those abilities. We were still a part of the monarchical theocracy at that point. There is no document that was based in the founding that allowed us to maintain this citizenry, basically creating a government within a government. We created our representative government, and thank God you actually have legislators in your county. You already have them. You need to hold them accountable. You don't go off and create your own little government because, you know, you're afraid of actually having the difficult conversations of how the Constitution being violated. Well, get over that. It is every one of our responsibilities to actually hold every public servant accountable to the Constitution, because they're duty-bound and obligated to support it based on their oath. So with that, there's a lot of other efforts out there. The Convention of States, now there's Conventions of Counties, and it's growing and growing. All of this is creating this division. Folks, there's only one that is behind contention. It is not coming from our Creator. It's not coming from our Savior. The contentious spirit and those who are creating all these contentions, that's coming from Lucifer. That's coming from Satan. He's the one that's trying to ensure that we do not successfully unite on the Constitution. That's the only way we're going to save this puppy. We proved this to you this entire show through the course of the content we cover for the entire year. This is irrefutable. And when I say irrefutable, unless you can refute Madison and Jefferson and the framers of how they laid out this Constitution and how they described it and how they explained what and how everything happens, then it's inarguable. It's immutable. Welcome back, Sean, and welcome back, Tammy. So let me just kind of move forward. I kind of want to address this because this constantly comes up, the general assemblies, these concoctions of, oh, this is the way we can do this. And there's people out there that are just buying into this. And I'm going, oh, my gosh. And this is, there's so much, it's kind of like the same people going around, or there's similar people going around that's talking about the doctrine of lesser magistrate. The doctrine of lesser magistrate does not fly in our constitutional republic. Anybody using that term is not based on the Constitution. They're based on the romance of the British monarchy. And, you know, America still seems to be in these grips. Oh, we love, I mean, I can't believe how many people spent time watching Charles become the dolt of Britain. Anyway, and it's, I guess it's just a coincidence. Adult is a four-letter word just like king, huh? Anywho, so Sean, for your benefit, we covered the 11th Amendment, and I know you and I covered the 11th Amendment when we covered the Article 3, Section 2, and we're going to cover the 12th Amendment, maybe today, maybe not, but we've already covered that as well, folks. So if you want to dive into the more details regarding the jurisdiction of the courts, go back to Article 3, Section 2. And if you want to dive into more on the Electoral College and the choosing of the president, go back to Article 2. I think it's Section 1. So with all of that, let's look at the one amendment, because remember, I say this all the time, and now we actually have the opportunity to actually learn something about the Constitution from an amendment that was never passed Congress. Congress chose not to entertain this amendment. And this amendment, which was unproposed by Congress, and it's in both of our color-coded constitutions, we include all amendments that were proposed and sent to Congress for one reason or the other. This amendment was sent to Congress from the President of the United States. And that President of the United States happened to be Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson proposed this amendment to Congress in response to the new acquired Louisiana Territory. And so this was a draft amendment that's laid out there. And GR's not making this up. You can find this on the Yale education website, the Avalon Project, and you can download this yourself. It is obscured because when you realize what he's asking the Constitution or the federal government to be able to obtain these powers, it's going to shock you to think that they're exercising these powers today. When Thomas Jefferson said, no, we need to amend the Constitution because we can't exercise these powers. So let's look at this amendment, and actually, because there's no highlights to it because it's never been ratified, let's just actually dive into this. And so, Sean, why don't you go ahead and take off? Welcome back, Tammy, by the way.
Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. And so, let's dive into this first paragraph. And if there's a point in question or anything like that, by all means, feel free to, what is he saying here or whatever, but by all means, let's see if we can just take this first chunk off. Let's go ahead.
Thomas Jefferson's draft on an amendment to the Constitution, 1803. The province of Louisiana is incorporated with the U.S. and made part thereof. The rights of occupancy in the soil and of self-government are confirmed to the Indian inhabitants as they now exist. Pre-exemption only of the portions rightfully occupied by them, and a succession to the occupancy of such as they may abandon, with the full rights of possession as well of property and sovereignty in whatever is not or shall cease to be so rightfully occupied by them, shall belong to the U.S.
Okay, so what he's basically laying out that in this amendment, there are these occupations. In other words, of course, in the Louisiana Territory, it's huge. There are tribes out there that they're kind of occupying land. Now, right, wrong, or indifferent, the paradigm of the Indian tribes were that they didn't possess land, they didn't own the deeds or what have you. And they had, they believed the land was for the living. The land was for everybody. But what Jefferson wanted to do in this amendment was basically, allocate to them the land that they had, what they, kind of claimed for their hunting and for their, what have you. This is something that the federal government did not have the ability to do, or at that point, all land that fell into the U.S. was under the jurisdiction and control of the United States. In other words, the territories were fully under the cognizance, and no other government or no other entity was identified to share that other than when a state became a state out of that territory. And when a state became a state, they took full sovereignty over that entire block of land that was within that state. The Constitution did not allocate or allow for the recognition, and actually, it was antithetical to the framers to think that you could have a state within a state. If that's the case, then every county could secede from the state and create their own states. And it is pretty well conceded that that can't happen because the state itself is sovereign. Now, that's not that the counties can't secede. They just can't create a state in a state. Because when you look at Article 4, because we covered this in Article 4, Section 3, that the only way a state could become a state out of the property or boundaries within that state is by the assent or by the approval of the state legislature. So for you to create a state for an Indian tribe, the state legislature would actually have to approve that to be so. The federal government, through treaties, now this is the point of this, and we're going to get into this in this next paragraph. The federal government does not have the ability to basically grant their own control over land to basically give to Indians to occupy on federal property. They couldn't give it to the Indians, nor did they have the authority to hold the property for themselves. Remember, the treaties can only be done based on the authority given. So when it comes to the authority of property, the federal government has the authority to possess magazines, dockyards, arsenals, and forts. In other words, military installations. They don't have the authority to possess land that would house or host a group or a tribe of people, or even a large quantity of trees, a forest, or a park. They have no authority in that constitution to possess those types of lands. So they can't go off and create a treaty granting them the ability to do that. How do we know this? Because we covered this already this year, and it was Mr. Nicholas in the Virginia ratification debates that literally said that. That said that they cannot create a treaty that is not within their enumerated objects. They can only create treaties based on the powers given them. And if they don't have the power or the property given them, then they can't assume that property. And yet, folks, they do all the time. So let's get into this next one, because this next one has a lot of different parts to it. And we're going to actually a few parts, but some they're introducing a whole new concept. Jefferson was a brilliant man, and he realized that there were some real shortfalls that the federal government would want to actually have maybe extra powers that they didn't have in the Constitution, and therefore the second paragraph identifies some of these things. So, Tammy, you're up. And at any point in time, Tammy, if you hit something that you go, well, this is what is this, or if you find it interesting, by all means, pause at will and make any comments you want. Go ahead.
The legislature of the union shall have authority to exchange the right of occupancy in portions where the U.S. have full right for lands possessed by Indians within the U.S. on the east side of the Mississippi, to exchange lands on the east side of the river for those on the west side thereof and above the latitude of 31 degrees, to maintain in any part of the province such military posts as may be requisite for peace or safety.
So, Tammy, if you paused right there,
okay.
He literally was saying that we want to be able to take Indians from the east side of the river and displace them to the west side of the river, of something they didn't have the authority to do. And Andrew Jackson actually assumed that power in 1830 or 1830, whatever, and basically put the Cherokee Nation on notice and put them on the Trail of Tears, where he killed thousands of them, where he didn't have the authority, because obviously Jefferson's trying to get this authority into the Constitution. And this was never accepted as an amendment. So go ahead and read the next part.
To exercise police over all persons therein, not being Indian habitants, to work salt springs or mines of coal, metals and other minerals within the possession of the U.S. or in any others with the consent of the possessors.
Okay, so right there, he's now introducing this concept that the federal government can now start possessing property for minerals. That mining, coal, iron, what have you, whatever was deemed a strategic need for the government, they could start taking this. And you know what? It's interesting, because he's the president at this point in time. And, you know, hey, if I have this ability, then we could actually start doing things as if he's king. And
so he's the one that started the for national security thing, right?
What's that? The national security? What?
Yeah, I said he's the one who started the I'm doing it for national security.
Okay. Yes. You know, again, this goes down the point of noble intent. I think Jefferson wanted to solve some problems because he realized that the Indians were going to create, there's, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, the biases of people are overwhelming. And the more illiterate people are, the more the biases become overwhelming. America at this point in time was very illiterate. They were being divided over demographics, i.e. race, gender, and so forth, right? And so the white males, right, wrong, or indifferent, the prevailing thought amongst the illiterate was that we needed to protect our, you know, ourselves. And again, that was the illiterate, because Thomas Jefferson saw otherwise, wanted to see things otherwise, but and actually protect other people from the, you know, I'll just say from the hands of illiterate people, because they're dangerous. Stalin, actually, no, I think it was Lenin, that called the illiterate mass mobs of Russia the useful idiots. And in this context, they didn't want to use these idiots. They wanted to protect these different people. I mean, Jefferson had also laid out a plan, because we've talked about this before, to repatriate the freedmen blacks in America back to Africa, because he knew that they were going to be basically hounded by, you know, the mass illiterates, the idiots of America. And he can't educate America, so he's trying to actually try to protect the rights of other types of citizens or other races and so forth. So anyway, go ahead and take it from the next part here.
To regulate trade and intercourse between the Indians, the Indian inhabitants, and all other persons, to explore and ascertain the geography of the province, its productions, and other interesting circumstances.
Go ahead, keep going.
To open roads and navigation therein where necessary for beneficial communication, and to establish agencies and factories therein for the cultivation of commerce, peace, and good understanding with the Indians residing there.
Okay, and so he had this kind of generic area, because at this point in time, they were just moving Indians from the east side into the west side. But actually, as we're going to discover in the last paragraph, he has a very specific map of a layout of the latitude. And so, Sean, I'll let you go ahead and look up where the 31 degree latitude is in respect to America. And if you look at the Louisiana Purchase, this 31 degree latitude was the southern barrier of this area that he was going to give to the Indians. And it went all the way to the north of that part of the, help me out here, to that part of that Louisiana Purchase, that would be basically federal property where they would allow the Indians to basically, you know, cohabitate with them, and that the federal government would be using this land for mining and its resources, where the Indians would basically just be able to live freely in these large, this is a large area. So if you look that up, and I'm going to read this, and this is what this third paragraph says. The legislature shall have no authority to dispose of the lands of the province otherwise than is hereinbefore permitted until a new amendment of the Constitution shall give that authority. So in other words, they're going to create this area that Congress cannot touch until another amendment comes along and says, okay, we're not going to dispose of this. Except as to the portion thereof which lies to the south of the latitude of 31 degrees. In other words, the area that Congress can meddle with is the 31 degrees and south, which whenever they deem expedient, they may erect into a territorial government, either separate or as making part. We just ran out of time. So, folks, I will finish reading these last lines when we come back, and then I'll let Sean kind of describe what he's seeing on the map of the Louisiana Purchase and that 31 degree How much of the Louisiana Territory is Thomas Jefferson actually giving to the Indians and to the U.S. government for permanent hold? We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so getting back into this, and again, 31 degrees latitude, and if I remember, the Macon County line for the southern states to become a part of the, you know, I should say, all states that joined the Union below the Mason-Dixon line would be slave states. I believe that latitude was 40-some degrees. So 31 degrees, I'm telling you folks, this is south of that. And as a matter of fact, the bottom edge, the bottom boundary, the southern boundary of Missouri was the Mason-Dixon line. So, that being a 40 degrees in the southern part of Missouri, you're going to realize that the Jefferson was literally taking this huge block of land for the benefit of the Indians, and it, in a symbiotic relationship between the Indians and the U.S. government and being able to tap the resources for the national needs. But anyway, so this is what it says. Which, whenever they deem expedient, they may erect into a territorial government, either separate or as making part with one on the eastern side of the river, vesting the inhabitants thereof of all the rights possessed by the territorial citizens of the United States. So, in other words, everything south was going to become states and a part of the U.S. government, and he was even including the ability to straddle, in other words, extend the government from the east side of the Mississippi to the west side. Interesting, because I don't think there is a state that does that. I think that the Mississippi line was the boundary for all those states along that river. So anyway, did you get a chance, Sean, to actually look up the 31st degree that goes across and how much of the Louisiana Purchase were we talking about? And you might be muted. I think you are. Yeah. So, Sean, did you get a chance to look that up? And so...
I looked it up.
You did? Okay, great. Go ahead. So where does that line go? How far south? In other words, does it actually go down to the Mexican border? Because keep in mind, Mexico didn't exist at this point in time. Right? It was basically...
So it says roughly along the border between Texas and Mexico, then eastward through the deep south.
Okay. So...
Forms part of the Texas-Mexico border just north of Del Rio and Eagle Pass, and then passes near Sonora and Junction.
Right.
It crosses the central part of the state in Louisiana. It crosses the central part of the state. Passes through Mississippi, goes through Alabama,
okay.
Georgia.
Now, so if you're looking at the map of the Louisiana Purchase, so you can actually just see that, you know, the boundary going all the way from Louisiana all the way up north, I think possibly to Montana. I think Wyoming is a part of the Louisiana Purchase, but if you described percentage-wise, would that not be probably 90% of the land acquired in the Louisiana Purchase would have been locked down for the basically the Indians, the Indian tribes of America, and the U.S. government for its mining and its, you know, resources that the government would need? What do you? How would you break that down?
Yeah, it looks that way.
90% or more? Maybe 95%?
Yeah.
So, folks, the important part here is that Thomas Jefferson was not looking to necessarily build states out of this purchase. He wasn't looking to create, you know, this huge area of not well-claimed land. I mean, there was hardly, really, the only people out there, for the most part, were Indian tribes. There were very few settlers. Most people were going all the way to the west. And so what he was really doing here was giving the federal government the ability to do things that actually conflicted with the concept of the Constitutional Convention. In other words, the federal government wasn't to be involved in these types of things, like mining, resources, manufacturing, and those types of things. So as we look at, you know, what Thomas Jefferson was really doing, it was almost antithetical, because he was now basically taking on this manufacturing and industry that the federal government would do that, or at least do the mining of it. And who knows, they might actually, it would make sense that you would have the processing and everything else right out there where you're doing the mining, so that instead of shipping, you know, raw materials out, you basically ship finished products out. So I think my point is that I think Thomas Jefferson, right, wrong, or indifferent, was in this mode of, you know, trying to make this real noble attempt. Because this man had an affinity for all human beings. And one of the things I remember learning about Thomas Jefferson is he too had been bred, or I should say was raised, with hard biases that he never challenged until he actually really, you know, became prominent in his legal affairs. This is when he took on the first case for a mulatto. It was in 1770. And I've said this before, where this is where Thomas Jefferson argued points. He actually used the language in his legal arguments for this mulatto woman to become free. Because by law in Virginia, if you were mulatto, half black, half white, then your first half of your life, you would live a slave. The last half of your life, you would be able to be free. So they kind of started having these liberal laws that a person could actually become free. Well, the owner of this mulatto woman wasn't, you know, willing to abide by the law. So Thomas Jefferson took this case on. I think it was a pro bono, because I think he just took this on for this mulatto black slave or mulatto woman to free her. He ended up losing the case, but his argument that we were all created equal, that's where that came from. And so, you know, he had already had this, I think, a real change in challenging biases by this point in time, that later on, when he was involved in the Declaration of Independence, just a few years later, while he was residing in Pennsylvania with the Continental Congress, he was introduced to a black mathematician and I think a black poet. And he was just absolutely dumbfounded, because his paradigm was the standard paradigm of the illiterate, that black folk couldn't actually, you know, be capable of intellectual arguments or intellectual capacity of doing mathematics or even literary things like poetry. And he was absolutely blown away. And because of this, it literally changed, you know, his feeling for, you know, I think it It did two things. It made him actually challenge all of the biases that he had, because obviously he became a true friend and advocate for the Indian tribes of America. And we can see this in his presidency. If you didn't know, he had like 20 to 30 tribes come to the White House while he was president, and he used his skills. He used his language skills to help create the written language of each of the tribes, because they all had different languages. And so he helped them actually create the written language, and they all left with that. He had copies of all of this that he was, you know, when he retired, he was going to take that with him. And he did take it with him, and it all got destroyed because of these two idiots. But nevertheless, I'm just giving you the insight of this man called Thomas Jefferson. He was a lover of liberty, and he loved liberty for all. He became the advocate for liberty for all mankind. And as a matter of fact, I try to introduce this because he had a paradigm that went beyond your average framer. And if you've never heard of this, Jefferson used to say, the land is for the living, and he basically was referring to, I think, this ideological law called usufruct. And, you know, you want to be careful when you say that word, as obviously. But that concept meant that it was challenging perpetual ownership of property. Now, when they talked about property, we're not talking about maybe your home, your domicile. They're talking about the land of resources, where, you know, you go and hunt for food and so forth, because this concept became very common. I think it was German, but it became common in Europe that it was just wrong that the monarchs and the control of the land was, you know, being held by the government and not the people. And so the commonality was, you know, who needs this land to live? It's the people that are living today. And so he was a true liberal, was truly a liberal. But to close on this one amendment, this amendment kind of gives you a glimpse of, you know, the depth of this man's compassion for other people, you know, and in some extent at the expense of us Americans. Because when we really think about what he was doing, then you can't. I challenge, you know, either Sean or Tammy to come up with anybody that has ever, you know, gone to that extent of, you know, not necessarily hurting America, but trying to make sure that, you know, America was just with all people. He was the first man in America that I really think, you know, embraced this greater thing called humanity than anybody else. And so anyway, Sean, any comments, or Tammy, any comments on this?
Going back to the 31st latitude.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you discussed it. I really couldn't hear you. I had a issue going on, but
okay, go ahead.
That's at the northern border of Florida that goes all the way to the Mississippi, correct?
Yeah, so as Tammy basically identified, that if you drew that line across that southern part of the Louisiana Purchase, would you estimate that would the land being given to the Indians would have been 90% at least of that land? In other words, Thomas Jefferson was being very generous in you know, helping these great people that he became, you know, very fond of and wanted to help. He actually, their intent was try to incorporate them into the American dream and into this, you know, this great society. Most of the framers actually had that opinion. But again, as I stated at the beginning of the show, America, the majority of Americans were very illiterate. And you'll find that people that are illiterate tend to be, you know, I'll just say highly prejudiced. Because they just lack the education to start seeing beyond their limitations of understanding. So anyway, anything else, Sean? Tammy?
Oh, just one thing. It was only the Isle of Orleans and east, west of the Mississippi, correct?
Well, so you talk about the Louisiana Purchase?
Correct.
You'd have to pull up the map on that. I think that the Louisiana being a state, because I believe that was a part, that was actually east of the Louisiana as well as west. So the Louisiana Purchase actually did have a little bit of that western land. I think that's one of the reasons why Jefferson, and actually technically Louisiana, is the only state that bridges both sides of the Mississippi, right?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Okay, so when I look at the state of Louisiana and the Mississippi River, because I think I misspoke, I think the Mississippi River is the boundary of all states north of Louisiana, but I believe Louisiana is a state that actually has property or, you know, land on both sides of the river, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Once you get to that 31st parallel.
Right, okay.
31st latitude. And the reason I was asking that is because we have markers on our highways out here. Everything east of the Mississippi and north of New Orleans that's within the state used to be an independent republic called the West Florida Republic.
Okay.
And then it was annexed into the state.
Okay.
Because when Spain gave it up, it wasn't part of Louisiana territory.
Ah. Oh, okay. I see. Because we acquired the territory that was in the hands or the holding of France.
Right.
Which is
and
why that okay,
east
that makes
of
sense.
Mississippi was Spain.
Yeah, and that makes sense why in the treaty Spain had privileges of using the ports without taxation for 10 years, as well as France.
Yeah, that was probably part of the deal with giving them the land.
Yeah, okay, great. So, anyway, Tammy, anything else to add?
No, I don't.
Okay, all right. Well, let's now dive into, as a matter of fact, we covered the 12th Amendment in Article 2. And so let's try this. Tammy, do you remember what the 12th Amendment did? Because we're looking at, I don't know how many words, but I'll just quickly highlight this. And I will tell you that there are almost 400 words in this amendment. So it's a pretty lengthy amendment. Do you remember the things that the amendment actually changed out of the Electoral College process?
I don't.
Okay. So, Sean, now we go to you. We covered this, and I think I asked you to delineate the difference of the 12th Amendment from the original Electoral College process. Do you remember what few things that this did? Because when you look at this, you'd think that the 12th Amendment did a lot. And actually, if I remember correctly, it only did two or three minor things. Do you remember what those were?
No, not off the top of my head.
Okay, that's fine. Now, one of the things that they went through was if I remember correctly, they made it so that when they selected, because I don't remember this in Article 2, but when they select a president and vice president, at least one of the candidates cannot be a resident of their home state. Remember that?
Correct, yes.
Actually, I'm looking at Article 2. No, it actually states that. So that wasn't a difference. So the real differences were these, that instead of writing both candidates' names on one ballot, they had to write one candidate who was going to be president on a specific ballot, and then they had to write who they were choosing for vice president on a separate ballot.
Correct.
In other words, they were to choose who was going to be the president and who was going to be the vice president. They were not to be hamstrung by parties. They were not to be hamstrung by anything, other than, you know, the electors chose the president. Right? In other words, when you really look at this, because the very first part of this, it says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct. Does it say that the state legislature can dictate the outcome? No. They can appoint in such manner as they elect. In other words, they have the ability to decide, you know, how the people are going to choose, the manner of how they choose their electors. Nowhere here were they granted the ability to determine the outcome of the electors, if that makes sense. So the one thing that they could change, and they did change through this amendment, was they went to two separate ballots that the electors would have to identify who was vice president and who was to be president. Because in the old process, they basically took all the names and whoever had the most became president, and then who had the second most became the vice president. And in the new process, go ahead, Tammy. Go ahead.
No, I looked it up. And so.
Oh, okay.
That's what all it right. says. Before each elector cast two votes for president, and then the one with the most became president, the one with the least
there you go.
Became the vice president.
Right. And so the other thing that changed was the down select. In other words, the Electoral College really only had one shot at defining who the president was going to be and who the vice president was going to be. And if they couldn't do it, then where did it go? They took the results of the Electoral College, in other words, who the top two or top three candidates were out of the Electoral College, and they basically take this into Congress after one shot. Prior to that, the Electoral College had to work it in down select and so forth. There was really, there wasn't this cap, because that's why the Electoral College suffered in 1800 in getting everything to finally get up to I think that it still went to the House, but it just took more time because they didn't have this limitation. And so that basically made it so that it got into Congress's hands faster, so that Congress could resolve the matter, you know, immediately. They would go into chambers and they would choose the president out of the top two or top three, depending on, you know, the total votes that were granted. In other words, if you actually had a case where there were just marginal differences between the top three, then, you know, that's why you would have a top three. But if you had two that there was no really close contender to them, then you'd only take the top two. And they actually get into the numbers and so forth. But the bottom line is those are the only two things. The 12th Amendment only made those two changes. And nowhere is there a mention of the party. Nowhere is there a mention of a primary to down select or anything like that. And technically, when you think about the primary, folks, think about it this way. The primary is party business for the party to choose who they want to down select in that election, in the primary election. It is strictly a party election. Why are you paying for it? That's a hard question that everybody needs to ask. Why are you, are we the people, paying to support the party's process?
And I don't even understand how constitutionally, legally, they can do that. From learning from what you're talking about, it's supposed to be the electors choose the person, not the party chooses the person. And then all electors go, okay, we're going with this guy.
Yeah, so to answer that question, you have to look at the party in a broader sense. Because when we think party, we think of the grassroots groups. You know, the guys down in the counties and at the state level and then national level. These are the activists, the political activists.
But actually, when I look at it, I see it coming from the top down.
Well, so, right. So technically, the elected officials are a separate party. In other words, when you look at the Republicans in office and you look at the Republican Party, now, so Tammy, because you're a part of the party, you can actually affirm this. If you actually sat down and said, you know, are those Republicans that are in office, are they involved in the party business, the party platform, and those things, or they isolate themselves so that they're actually sterile of the party? And I think, Tammy, you'll agree that those politicians – You know, you may have some that are good with the party. They do support the party, but most of them don't. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Which means that you actually have a different party type of apparatus when these guys go into office. And I think they have their own little play sheet, which is why they have created laws in every state to make it hard for the party to oust them.
Yeah.
And in so doing, they basically have created this honor amongst thieves where they can protect themselves and be able to all continue to work together to further the cause of globalism or whatever they're selling us downriver for. Because
yeah, I mean, currently in our house, we have a majority of legislators who support the party. So that's good.
Okay. All right. So now we got 2 minutes left. So this next amendment is the original 13th Amendment. And if you have read Why Counties Matter Most, you will actually be introduced to this amendment. Now, this amendment was not, this is one of the few amendments from the very beginning, like the Electoral College was the only other one that I know of. Well, actually Thomas Jefferson's, but it didn't become an amendment. But anyway, I digress. This 13th Amendment actually came and was introduced by Congress to the states. And so one of the things that I need to do before they all go away is I need to actually pull in the debates in Congress during the drafting in 1810, the drafting of this amendment. And the reason why is because I think it's important to expose why did Congress choose to create what we would call the Nobility Amendment. Folks, I'm here to tell you that this amendment was ratified and is still a legitimate amendment. The only reason we've completely, it's not there, is because the courts, and there was a huge power play in America to deceive America that this amendment was not legitimately ratified. And I say that because we actually have artifacts from the 1870s that actually identified that this was a legitimate amendment. And folks, 1870s, that's 60 years later. So they didn't get to expunge this. And the efforts of expunging this went on steroids after the Bar Association was created, because they realized that the Bar Association, most people forgot about this amendment. The Bar Association knew that this was pointing the finger of judgment at them, that if you were a Bar Associated attorney or judge, you could not be a citizen of the United States. That's why this amendment is so important. And so when we come back, we're going to dive into this baby so that we can actually kind of just go through this real quick. Again, one of the things I need to do is I actually need to pull in the congressional debates on this. And oh, if you actually have time, folks, any of you listening, you've got time and you wanted to help me do some of the research, by all means, let me know. And we will actually, I'll get you or help you understand how to pull in these images of the congressional debates. That way we can actually consolidate them all and have them. Because we all need to see this. We all need to hear why these men justified and why this is so important. I'm Gian Mobley. We reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.